You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, state Republican lawmakers put out their proposal to update the shared revenue system here in Wisconsin. Our guest digs into the numbers and what they could mean for communities around the state, big and small. Now, ProPublica reported last month that U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas accepted years' worth of luxury trips on super yachts and flights on private jets from Harlan Crow, a billionaire Republican donor. Justice Thomas has characterized the trips as personal hospitality from a longtime family friend and said that public disclosure was not required. ProPublica is also reporting that Crow paid for the private education of a relative of Justice Thomas and bought a home from Justice Thomas where the justice's mother still lives. Neither the trips nor the purchases had been previously disclosed. Chief Justice John Roberts declined to testify to the Senate Judiciary Committee in a hearing about ethics, citing concerns about judicial independence and the separation of government powers. Republican senators dismissed last week's Judiciary Committee hearing as a partisan attack on the court's legitimacy and conservative majority. Democratic senators argued that the lower courts and other branches of government are held to higher ethical standards than the Supreme Court. The recent revelations and political wrangling have raised some questions about ethical rules and responsibilities for the nation's top court and the effects they can have on our confidence in the judicial system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about judicial ethics? What's your response to the recent news stories about Justice Thomas and some other justices, money they've received, whether they had to disclose it or not? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Russ Feingold is a former Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin. He's president of the Progressive American Constitution Society. He's authored the book, The Constitution in Jeopardy. Senator Feingold, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon. You bet.
What, compare and contrast for us, what are the differences in ethics guidelines for Supreme Court justices versus the whole rest of the federal judicial system?
Well, this is just an amazing thing in light of these revelations. The people who are on the federal courts, both at the Court of Appeals levels, as in the Seventh Circuit for Wisconsin, or district court judges who sit in Madison or Milwaukee, are part of a national ethics code that is enforced by the judicial conference that says, look, you have to disclose personal gifts and various things that you've received. There are rules about situations where you have to or should recuse yourself from deciding in a case. In other words, not help rule on the case because you might have a personal interest. And somehow it's evolved that the United States Supreme Court doesn't have to abide by those rules. The executive branch has rules, the Congress has rules, the lower courts have rules at the state level, the state legislators do, and the judges do, but somehow the Supreme Court is exempt, and you might say, well, that's because they're beyond reproach. But these recent revelations about Justice Thomas show just the opposite. They show a shocking lack of judgment to think that one should accept this kind of gift, and it is high time for the Supreme Court to have serious ethics rules like everybody else.
With the Justice Thomas stories in particular, one of the responses has been, and I think this was in the National Review, there's no quid for quo here, that, okay, yes, a friend of Justice Thomas gave him lucrative travel and things like that, but we can't point toward a specific instance where this particular gift resulted in any difference in how Justice Thomas behaved as a judge. So no reason for concern there would be the argument.
Well, if you were trying to criminally prosecute him for having taken a quid pro quo, that would be one thing. But that isn't what this is. This is about ethical disclosure. Members of Congress can't avoid disclosing their personal interests on the argument that you can't prove a quid pro quo. It's a requirement that you have to let the public know. It has to do with public confidence. And, you know, ProPublica reports that Justice Thomas had this financial relationship with Harlan Crow, and that there were secret payments to his wife, Ginny Thomas. We're now hearing about tuition being paid for a great nephew of his. We're also hearing about other justices potentially involving real estate deals. I mean, none of this has to do necessarily with a situation that would lead to a criminal prosecution. But what it has to do with is that the public has a right to know that the highest court in the land is disclosing their personal interests. And if anyone really believes that these kinds of extreme gifts to Justice Thomas doesn't have some influence on him. I've got a bridge I'd like to sell you.
Chief Justice Roberts declined to come before the Senate Judiciary Committee, as I mentioned, at this hearing, saying it raises concerns over the separation of powers. Who, if we want Supreme Court ethical guidelines changed, who gets to change them?
Well, the court itself should be doing the job, but it isn't. And Congress can pass a law signed by the president, either insisting that the court do it itself or create its own rules. That is not anything that is violating Congress's role. And, you know, it's interesting because I was involved in the confirmation of Justice Thomas or Judge Thomas when he was then Judge Roberts when he was then Judge Roberts. And I asked him questions under oath, as a senator does on Judiciary Committee. And I asked him what you could do to prevent special interests from lobbying judges. And he said that he didn't think special interests should be allowed to lobby federal judges. And so he made a under oath statement to that effect. And it seems to me that it would have been perfectly appropriate for him to appear in response to this request. It was not a subpoena, to appear at the hearing to allow him to explain how the court does this work and to allow members of Congress who have a right to legislate on this or to investigate this to ask questions. He should have done it. I suppose he didn't do it because he felt it was something that Congress shouldn't be able to do, but I think he's wrong about that. And I voted for him. I voted for him because I thought he would be an even-handed Chief Justice. In some ways he has been, but I think he's mishandling this situation by basically acting like the emperor has no clothes, that there isn't a problem, that we're not to worry about what's happening with the court. But these allegations against Justice Thomas are very serious, and they're undermining the Supreme Court's legitimacy and the rule of law, which harms all of us, not just Democrats, not just Republicans. So I think Roberts should go before the Judiciary Committee voluntarily.
Talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, its ethical guidelines, where it doesn't have ethical guidelines. Russ Feingold is with us, former member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, former senator from Wisconsin. You could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, Russ. A big problem is people tend to vote on what they figure standards should be. Like, you and I agree on some things, we agree, disagree on other things, but why don't we get to some fundamental questions? Like, an example would be, if you have a fetus inside a pregnant human body, is that fetus human or is it not? If it's not human, then what
Dennis,
is it?
Dennis, you're bringing us to another issue. Do you have thoughts on the ethics of the Supreme Court here?
Part of it is a lot of... Russ Feingold and others would be most likely against Thomas and others because of their stance on abortion, which I'm against abortion, but I'm against Thomas and others being unethical financially.
Dennis, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. So I think, Dennis, getting to the difficulty in confirming Supreme Court justices over a political view, a political difference, like an issue like abortion versus what he says is a fundamental ethical view, like we're talking about, Senator Feingold.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough. It's very important for me to for people to realize that this the question about what's happened with ethics and the lack of rules at the Supreme Court is completely distinct from the terrible things that the Supreme Court has been doing with regard to its politicizing decisions, undermining Roe v. Wade, really taking an extreme view on guns, undermining the right to vote. But this program today is not about that series of serious problems that we need to address, because the court has been politicized by essentially stealing justices from Democratic presidents. This is about something else. This is about the fact that regardless of your political party, regardless of your vote on abortion or anything else, you should have to tell the American people about special gifts and interests that you receive. It doesn't necessarily mean in all cases you can't get them, but they should and must be disclosed. That's the issue here.
Thanks for that call. I want to give a listen to Senator Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island talking about how this kind of influence might work. Talking here about the late Justice Antonin Scalia accepting over 7 dozen, apparently undisclosed, hunting vacations.
It was systematized. Some intermediary would ask the owner of an expensive resort, often a commercial property, to extend to Scalia a personal invitation to the resort. Even where the owner was someone he'd never met, Scalia treated as personal hospitality because of the personal invitation and failed to disclose the vacations. Gun industry advocates, fossil fuel folks, and Republican political figures often tagged along. No reasonable reading of the term personal hospitality would cover this, but the Supreme Court let this go on for years.
And Senator Feingold, that idea of personal hospitality, you know, you stay over with a relative or an old friend or something like that, it's exempt from these reporting guidelines as they exist for the U.S. Supreme Court. Senator Whitehouse there suggesting that offers a potentially very big loophole.
Of course, Senator Whitehouse is completely correct. You know, under Wisconsin state legislative laws that I lived under for under 10 years, you couldn't even get a cup of coffee from a lobbyist or somebody like that. You couldn't go on these trips without disclosing them. Some legislators went to jail or were convicted because of personal hospitality or gifts they received from lobbyists in Wisconsin. So the idea that this kind of annual good old boy hunting trip isn't a violation of this and shouldn't be reported is on its face ridiculous. Of course it should be reported. And the American people have a right to know that their justices, not just judges, but justices of the Supreme Court are in these kind of buddy-buddy situations that obviously have an influence on the perspective of a judge. You know, I grew up with people like Tom Fairchild and Jim Doyle, judges at the state and federal level, who clearly understood that as a judge, you have to give up certain of those things you might have had if you had stayed in law practice or in business. Being a judge is a different thing. And it's high time the Supreme Court justices and those who are not reporting this information understand that.
Talking to Russ Feingold, former Democratic senator from Wisconsin, current president of the American Constitution Society, looking at ethics guidelines for U.S. Supreme Court justices. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how this works? Do you worry about the fairness of the courts? Do you want to see Congress step in and try to impose some kind of ethical guidelines on Supreme Court justices? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with former Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, Russ Feingold. He was on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and we're talking about the ethical standards we hold for our nation's highest court after reports of undisclosed gifts and payments to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and his family. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. First off, I just wanted to say thank you for mentioning Senator Whitehouse and bringing that up. I really appreciate everything he's bringing to the table. Second of all, these Republican mega donors, whether it's Harlan Crow or I believe it's Leonard Leal, they have made their positions extremely forward. And the notion that their gifts, Justice Roberts, Justice Thomas, and others on the high court doesn't have some kind of influence, I think it's just a mistake. And also, I think that having any confidence that the high court is going to do the right thing, if you will, I have very low confidence that they will at this point. I think it's shameful of the high court, and I think we, the people, definitely need to kind of make a stand here.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. Senator Feingold, if people agree with Chris and want to change things, what could individual people do?
Well, he couldn't be more right. That's exactly the problem. This isn't just about individual justices not revealing information. The court itself is losing its legitimacy. The polls show an enormous drop in the public's view of the United States Supreme Court, and that's very dangerous for our system. The idea in the past was that the court was supposed to be the least dangerous branch, because Congress had the sword or the purse and the president had the sword, and they just had to have public credibility to support their ability to rule on congressional issues, whether they're constitutional or not. So it is crucial that the court be legitimate. So I think the next step here, I don't think there's any justification for flailing around, but the next step is to call Justice Thomas before the Judiciary Committee. If he comes voluntarily, which is extremely unlikely, fine. If not, he needs to be subpoenaed in order to be questioned and to let him explain his view of what he did and for there to be an investigation. So before people start talking about whether he should resign or whether he should be impeached or all the things that could happen, the first thing is to find out his perspective and to have members of the Senate to have the right to question him about it. That needs to be done. They already held a hearing generally on the subject, which is good. So this should be a step-by-step thing. One thing we can't do, though, is to just let this go, because this is undermining the credibility of the highest court in the land.
Thanks for that call, Chris. Wendy joins us now in Duluth. Wendy, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. You know, I have to kind of chuckle. To me, this seems like just basic common sense. But I'm reminded as I'm driving here about, I was a vendor, an outside vendor for a company that's owned by the wealthiest man in the state of Wisconsin. And we as vendors could not so much as buy a cup of coffee or a lunch for anyone in within that company because it was seen as, you know, lobbying or pandering right. or buying off, and it was not allowed. Now, that happens to be a conservative company. Everybody in business knows that this is not ethical. And so, really, this isn't politics. This is common sense, and we have come so far from common sense in this country that it's just sad.
Wendy, thanks for the call. Senator Feingold.
Said it perfectly. It's just common sense. It's just a no-brainer, obviously. The justice should not be able to take a private plane for a vacation in Indonesia or go on a huge yacht trip without telling the American people that they're doing it. And yeah, you're talking about a Wisconsin tradition that I was always proud of. I actually brought it to Washington, a gift van for members of Congress. They used to be able to get all kinds of stuff until McCain and I shut that down. And I'm pleased to hear that, and I think it is, followed in the private sector often as well. There is no excuse for this to be the system for our Supreme Court. And it is just common sense.
Thanks for that call, Wendy. Jed joins us now in Lacouderie Reserve. Jed, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Jed?
My main issue is it just seems like people aren't following their own rules. Or there's different sets of rules, and it makes it really confusing for the average citizen or any official. I think about the metal detectors in Washington that some people, they set them up and they just slide by. Or I think about, you know, and perhaps it occurs to me that it's just capitalism showing its true face, that it's just sheer nepotism, cronyism, and hypocrisy. And I'm not for any of those things, but if they come to light and people realize essentially that's what the systems are based on.
I gotcha, Jed. Thanks for the call. Senator Feingold, Jed says he's concerned about different sets of rules for different people. I mean, is it as simple as establishing, hey, the same rules that apply to all the other federal judges should apply to the Supreme Court justices?
Well, that would go a really long way. I mean, I think there was a thought over time that the Supreme Court would never get involved in this kind of thing, that they would have the dignity to know better, but that's not where we're at. So we need to get these rules in place, either by the Supreme Court or by the Congress. And keep in mind, if there were some decision with regard to Justice Thomas, it wouldn't be the first time. President Johnson appointed a Democrat appointee, Justice Fortas, somebody who was already on the Supreme Court, to be the Chief Justice. And it would have been the first Democrat appointed Chief Justice in my lifetime. And he didn't get through because there were some ethical questions raised about his relationship with the foundation. And he not only had to resign from, he didn't become Chief Justice, he also had to resign from the Supreme Court. So this isn't partisan. It's been done on the Democratic side. It could be done on the Republican side. It's about simply having some rules in place. And as the caller said, having people not think they could have two different sets of rules.
Thanks for that call. Janet joins us now in Lone Rock. Janet, hello.
Hello. Thank you. Most of what I wanted to say has already been said, but I would like to just say that I think one of the reasons that there isn't more public outcry for this is because of the lack of civics in school. And so many people don't even understand what the three branches of government are or what the rules are supposed to be. But absolutely, the Supreme Court judges should be the stellar example of a judge's behavior rather than the lowest bar where all of our county and state, you know, judges have to follow rules that they don't have to. And I think there definitely should be an investigation in Congress and both the judge and his wife. And then let's keep going and let's do term limits and put some other guidelines on these justices, because this is just totally, totally unacceptable, and it should, and everybody should be taken to the streets over this. It's ridiculous.
Janet, thanks for the call. Senator Feingold, Janet's case that, you know, maybe we've lost a certain element of our civic understanding and not grasping the implications here. What do you think?
Well, amen to that. There's no question about it. People need to be taught at an early age that the role of the Supreme Court is to be independent and not political. And the problem now is the court has become so political and so politicized and such an agenda that if you combine that with ethical concerns and violations, what you have is an institution that loses its justification to exist. And so it is time for an investigation. It is time for action. And it is necessary, apparently, for Congress to step in a situation where you wish it didn't have to. I also agree with the caller, and American Constitution Society endorses either adding justices to the court to balance what's happened, or, as she said, term limits. We think it's time that it would make sense to have some kind of limitation, maybe 18 years for the time a justice can serve on the court. It's not working the way it's done right now.
Thanks for that call, Senator Feingold. And just our last half a minute, Republicans, including on the Judiciary Committee, say the politicization is these attacks, these overblown attacks, they would say, on the justices. Give us 30 seconds to respond to that.
Well, that's just ridiculous. Some of the investigations that have come out are talk about justices who have been appointed by people on both sides of the aisle. And I think that the members of the Judiciary Committee know very well that if they tried to pull this, if they tried to take these kind of yacht trips and not report it on their ethics forms, they'd be in big trouble before the Senate Ethics Committee, and they might be expelled from the Senate. So the idea that it's just politics, when it's the same thing that could throw them out of the Senate, is silly.
Senator Feingold, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Russ Feingold, former Democratic senator from Wisconsin, current president of the American Constitution Society. He served on the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, and he joined us today for a look at the ethical standards in place for justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, are you flooded with junk mail? Get some advice on how to stop the flow of unwanted ads in your mailbox, and maybe call in and share your least favorites. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. When you think about the great villains of literature and fantasy, you probably don't think about butterflies. But now there's a direct connection between one of the evilest characters in fantasy fiction and cool-looking but mostly harmless butterflies. As reported in the New York Times science section, researchers have named a new genus of butterflies after Sauron, the ultimate bad guy in the Lord of the Rings books and movies. What's the connection? Are the butterflies launching an evil scheme to capture the Ring of Power, then send their minions on a war of conquest? No, at least not as far as we know. But they do have these circles on their wings that look a little bit like the Eye of Sauron, as depicted in art and on film. There are two species in this genus so far, more expected to be discovered. The butterflies aren't the first scientific tribute to Sauron. There's a dinosaur, a dung beetle, and a frog, plus a faraway galaxy named after him. Having a species named after you? Welcome to the club, Sauron. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a close look at the way Wisconsin state tax money goes to local governments. Governor Evers and state Republican leaders have different plans. We'll find out how they could affect communities around the state. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about baseball.
The early 1940s saw the rise of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League.
That All-American pastime, baseball, brings out the All-American Girl Baseball League for spring training at Alexandria, Virginia. Two teams are working out, the Fort Wayne Daisies and the Racine Belles, getting in shape for an opening day doubleheader.
Author Dean Robbins tells us about a memorable moment from the league's historic run.
A major event in sports history took place in September 1943. Two teams played in the first championship series of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. Both were from Wisconsin.
Okay, gals, play ball.
The league was founded that year to keep fans coming to ballparks while male players served in World War II. it held tryouts for women around the United States and Canada and picked top prospects for the first four teams, the Racine Bells, Kenosha Comets, Rockford Peaches, and South Bend Blue Sox. The female athletes had the rare opportunity to get decent salaries, play for big crowds, and bask in media attention.
These league champions play 126 games a season and earn up to $100 a week. Nice going, girls.
Unfortunately, there was no avoiding 1940s-style sexism. The women had to follow strict rules for grooming and manners. They were even forced to wear ladylike uniforms, including short skirts that offered no protection for their legs when sliding into bases.
Gene Bunsett, the squeeze is on. Tibby Eisen slides home with a run and a nicely bruised leg. Better a bruise than long pants, eh, gals?
At first, the public viewed the women as mere novelties. But fans soon realized that these were serious ballplayers, according to the Racine Belle's Sophie Curis. She shared this in an interview with Grand Valley State University.
You know, we were a curiosity to begin with. And then when they came out and saw that we could really play, then they came out in droves and we did really well.
The All-American Girls Professional Baseball League proved popular in Wisconsin. Kenosha's Helen Nicole emerged as the 1943 season's best pitcher, with 31 wins and 220 strikeouts. In the All-Wisconsin Championship Series that fall, the Bells bested the Comets in three straight games, with Racine catcher Irene Hickson batting a torrid .417. The league expanded to 10 teams, and attendance rose to nearly a million in 1948. But recruiting new players proved difficult, and owners cut back on expenses. In 1954, they shut down the operation amid a backlash against women playing baseball. But the players had made their mark, paving the way for other women's professional leagues. And even though it took a while, they got their due. They were honored by the National Baseball Hall of Fame and memorialized in Hollywood's A League of Their Own. Joyce Barnes McCoy pitched for the Kenosha Comets in 1943. Here she is describing her appearance decades later at a ball game in her native Hutchinson, Kansas.
Oh, they asked me to come and throw out a pitch, and when they introduced me, I stood up, and that whole grandstand was alive, was yelling and hollering, and so I waved, took my hat, waved at them, and then they started in again, and all the umpires and things, they took their hats off, and I had to autograph everything.
Yes, hats off to Joyce Barnes McCoy and other Wisconsin players from the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. It's good to know that, by the end of their lives, they finally had a chance to feel like All-American legends.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, Republican State Assembly leaders released their proposal last week for updating the state's shared revenue system. That system determines the amount of state tax money that is redistributed back to local municipalities. The current shared revenue structure has remained relatively stagnant since the early 2000s, but the demographics of townships, cities, and counties around the state have changed a lot over the time. The Republican proposal has gotten some pushback from state and local leaders who say the funding increases aren't enough and they come with a lot of restrictions on how the money could be used. Governor Tony Evers previously proposed his own changes to the state shared revenue system and said last week he would veto the Republican plan as it currently stands.
The state must step up more than what I've seen. It's why I can't support the Republican plan as is, and frankly, I'll veto it in its entirety. It is not enough resources. We have the resources to do it. Let's increase the money that's going to the locals. And frankly, also let's kind of remove all those restrictions that the legislation was putting on those local folks.
The Republican proposal is still in draft form. It could be tweaked before lawmakers vote on it. Our next guest broke down the numbers in both plans to see what they meant for communities around the state. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about state shared revenue and the Republican proposal? Do you want to see the state government increase the flow of funding back to local governments? If so, how should the money be divided? Should there be strings attached on what local governments can do with that money? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Philip Bracco is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. He wrote analyses of the Republican state shared revenue proposal and Governor Evers' proposal on the blog The Recombobulation Area. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Always good to be with you, Rob.
Let's talk about the concept of shared revenue. Sometimes I think it's portrayed as the state is giving money to local communities. People think of it differently, though. It's tax money that's collected in local communities in the first place. How should we think about shared revenue?
Yeah, so if you think about the history of shared revenue, the state starts doing this in 1911. And that year is important because that's also the year that the state preempts local governments from assessing income tax. And it enacts a number of property tax exemptions for the first time. And so basically what shared revenue is doing is the state saying, look, we're in control of all of these local units of government. We are taking away a source of revenue liquidity for you, really important sources of revenue. And so what we're doing is we're going to give back some of that revenue that we're essentially preempting you from taking advantage of. And the formula by which the state's done that is it's changed a little bit over the years. We really haven't updated the amounts that local governments are getting since the early 2000s. But the basic idea is a return of revenue to local communities rather than, I like to say, it's not a gift. Right. It is a return of revenue to counties and municipalities around the state.
There's a lot of differences between the two parties, but it does seem like there's general consensus, Phil, that something needs to change. Why is that?
Well, I think the consensus that you see has been built up over the last few decades where essentially the state has allowed the payment that local governments receive to remain flat, even though inflation is increasing every year, and even though the revenues that local communities are sending back to Madison or to the state government are increasing every year, the money has stayed flat. So, for example, right, if Milwaukee were to get what it sort of in inflation-adjusted terms, what it was owed, compared to 2001, right, it would be receiving about $400 million rather than $200-some million that it's receiving today. And so, you know, you can see that there's been demand for local governments. Every single legislative session, they sort of put these sort of demands up. But really, the state legislature has been pretty unwilling to move on those until this year. And so the thing that holds the governor and the state legislature's proposals in common is that they both represent an adjustment to that formula, reintroducing a formula so that it updates every year. But that's really where the similarities between the two proposals end. In almost every other important respect, and we can talk about what those are. Those two plans are pretty different.
Yeah, they get pretty complicated, but can you talk about kind of which communities gain the most from one proposal versus the other? Who are the winners and losers in the governor's plan versus the Republican plan?
Well, let's just start by talking about the size and scale of the two plans, right? Under Evers' proposal, the governor would allocate about $576 million additional dollars in state revenue aid or local revenue aid. The assembly bill is about half that, right? $277 million. So already when we're thinking about what's different between the two proposals, it's not just the distribution formula, how the money moves mm-hmm. around the state. It's just the amount of money overall. And so you've seen complaints from everybody from local officials in Milwaukee County to officials in Waukesha County, very different politically, but complaints about the overall size of the package. Now, the other thing that's important is the mathematical formula that's used to allocate that aid, right? So for a very long time, the formula that the state used said, look, we're going to give back money based on kind of the amount of revenue effort that you're putting in and the overall property value. So the idea was like tax-based equalization as well as your population. The governor's proposal kind of reintroduces that formula again. So it's basically kind of restoring it to what it would have been in the early 2000s, kind of where we left off last. The Republican formula is pretty different. It takes out that aidable revenue component entirely. So that component that's based on property tax values and revenue effort, and replaces it with a formula that varies. There's a formula for counties that is so complicated that I can't even really get into it on the radio. It is in fact too complicated for that. But for municipalities, the formula differs depending on the size of your municipality. So if you are a municipality with like less than 5,000 people, you have a little bit higher population multiplier. There's like a number that the population is multiplied by than larger cities. And what that means is that as a percentage of what they're getting now, local, very, very small municipalities, give an example of Popple River, which is, I think, in Forest County. It has a population of something like 43 people. I mean, it's going to see something like a 5,000% increase over what it's getting now, which is great for Popple River, by the way. By contrast, if you look at what a city like Milwaukee or Racine or Green Bay or La Crosse is going to be getting, they're going to be getting just about 10% more than they're getting now. So, you know, the idea of the Republicans' kind of proposal is like every community is going to get at least 10% more. But some communities, and particularly the smallest municipalities in the state, are going to get a lot more in a number of cases. It's like over 1,000% more than they're getting today.
Talking to Marquette University political science professor Phil Rocco about proposed changes to the state shared revenue system and what it would mean for communities big and small around Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this and what you've seen in the news so far? If you are closely involved in local budgets at whatever level, what do you want to see change? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Phil Rocco, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, with us to discuss the proposal by Republican lawmakers to update the state's shared revenue system with new funding and new limitations for local governments, how it stacks up against Governor Evers' plan. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Stephen is with us in Mount Pleasant. Stephen, hi.
Hello. The quota requirement to receive shared revenue, is that going to be seasonal, monthly, yearly? I don't understand how this is going to be placed, because this could have a drastic effect on off-season up north where there are no tourists, and all of a sudden you have to start busing the locals for being 2 miles an hour over the limit.
Oh, Stephen, it sounds like you're talking about police quotas. There were some strings involving either police numbers or their traffic violation quotas. Do I have that right?
Correct.
Thanks a lot for the call, Stephen. Phil, Stephen taking us into some of the strings attached. And yes, some of the funding is contingent on providing proof that you're not cutting back on police services in a community.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of differences here. So the governor's proposal, we'll just begin with what the new money can be used for. About 56% of the governor's proposal is just general revenue. That's kind of what's local governments have been used to getting from the state. It reserves 45% for public safety. With the Republican proposal, 100% of the aid is restricted for either public safety, EMS, or fire. So it's not general money. I want to make that clear at the outset. Then beyond that, there are a bunch of additional restrictions or strings attached to that. One of the strings I think that's gotten the most attracted the most controversy is this idea that in order to get the new money, local governments have to spend or contribute the same amount of effort, and that means a couple different things, to policing and other services that they did in the prior year. And the kinds of evidence that the governments can provide, that there's sort of four different criteria, and they have to provide evidence of two of them, is like you're spending the same, you have the same number of sworn officers. And then the ones that have attracted the most controversy are you're making the same number of arrests, or you are doing the same number of moving violations. And obviously that's, I think, those two things in particular have attracted controversy because there is currently a law on the books in Wisconsin that prohibits arrest quotas. But even if that's kind of out the door, the idea that you have to, that the state is going to determine kind of artificially, like what you should be spending on different categories of expenditures, I mean, that's attracted a lot of conflict and controversy from local officials around the state.
Thanks a lot for that call, Stephen. And Phil, it's not just police. There are a lot of concerns about various places where local leaders say, hang on, you're stepping on local control. Advisory referenda, I believe, go away. What other restrictions are you seeing concern about there?
Yeah, so there's some things like the prohibition on advisory referenda. So now under the Republican proposal, local governments would not be allowed to have advisory referenda on the ballot, which has attracted some controversy. There's some other things that are just preemptions. So preventing local public health officials from issuing orders in the event of a pandemic kind of event, unless they get special political approval for doing that. A preemption on local regulations of quarries, as well as for Milwaukee City and County, a whole host of other restrictions. So limiting what Milwaukee City and County can spend on arts funding, requiring a 2/3 vote of city and county legislative bodies in order to approve new spending, preventing the city from spending any levy money on a streetcar. I mean, it is a very high level of state control that the Assembly's bill is asking local governments to you know, give up autonomy in exchange for an amount of money that's about half what they would get under Evers' proposal.
Phil, as I mentioned, the Republican draft is a draft, so Republicans could change it. As I also mentioned, Governor Evers could veto the whole thing. If we just ride with the current budget and the current shared revenue plan, what are your concerns about what that would mean for communities around the state?
Well, right. And I think this is the sort of the bargaining situation that we're in right now. In a way, the status quo, especially for larger cities, is pretty unsustainable, right? And so, you know, in traditional legislative bargaining, if there is a status quo that is like really unacceptable and you can't get a better deal, you'd expect the parties to kind of accept the take it or leave it offer. The issue here, and I think the reason why Evers threatened to veto the legislation, and I think why the veto threat is credible, is that shared revenue measure that has a lot of strings attached that really fundamentally changes the logic of the program that had been in place for many, many years, and has unintended consequences that really haven't at this point even been analyzed. I think he's banking on the idea that that threat is credible because those kinds of restrictions are very unpopular across the state. And I think that it is possible that that could advance some bargaining. And if you look at the current kind of what lobbyist principals have kind of the positions they've registered on the bill, you know, it's not like all of the local governments have registered unequivocal support. 64% of the government of the lobbyists on the legislation have registered their stand as others. So neither oppose entirely nor support entirely. They all have sort of problems. Many of them have problems with it. There are some unequivocal supporters, and then there are some unequivocal opponents. So I think that does set up conditions of possibility for bargaining here. Although the one thing to note is that the governor's veto threat here is a full veto threat, because Republicans have styled this as a standalone bill rather than being part of the budget. The very strong veto pen that Evers traditionally wields in the budget process will not, the line item veto will not apply to this.
Thanks to Phil Rocco, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. We took a look at state shared revenue proposals. Tomorrow on Central Time, managing angry people with a Wisconsin psychologist. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, a related note, the Joint Finance Committee has made its first moves on the next state budget. We'll talk to Democratic Committee member Senator LaTanya Johnson about her priorities and the state legislature's relationship with Milwaukee. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.